But why Margrave? Finley said again.
Old Albert told me bad luck and trouble's been his only friend.
Geography and opportunity, I said.
It's in the right place. All kinds of highways meet down here, and it's a straight run on down to the boatyards in Florida. It's a quiet place, and the people who run the town were greedy scumbags who'd do what they were told.
He went quiet, thinking about the torrent of dollar bills rushing south and east, like a storm drain after a flood, a little tidal wave, a small and harassed workforce in Margrave keeping it rolling on. The slightest hitch and tens of thousands of dollars would back up and jam, like a sewer, enough money to drown a whole town in. He drummed his long fingers on the wheel, drove the rest of the way in silence. We parked up in the lot nearest the station house door. The car was reflected in the plate glass, an antique black Bentley, worth $100,000 on its own, with another $100,000 in the trunk. The most valuable vehicle in the state of Georgia. I popped the trunk lid, laid my jacket on top of the air conditioner box, waited for Finley, and walked up to the door. The place was deserted, apart from the desk sergeant. He nodded to us. We skirted the reception counter, walked through the big, quiet squad room to the Rosewood office in back, stepped in and closed the door. Finley looked uneasy.
"I want to know who the 10th guy is," he said. "It could be anybody. Could be the desk sergeant. There's been 4 cops in this already."
"It's not him," I said. "He never does anything. Just parks his fat ass on that stool. Could be Stevenson, though. He was connected to Hubble."
He shook his head.
"No," he said. "Teal pulled him in off the road when he took over. He wanted him where he could see him. So it's not Stevenson. I guess it could be anybody. Could be Eno, up at the diner. He's a bad-tempered type of a guy."
I looked at him.
"You're a bad-tempered type of a guy, Finley," I said. "Bad temper never made anybody a criminal."
He shrugged, ignored the jibe.
"So, what do we do?" he said.
"We wait for Roscoe and Picard," I said. "We take it from there." I sat on the edge of the big rosewood desk, swinging my leg. Finley paced up and down on the expensive carpet. We waited like that for about 20 minutes, and then the door opened. Picard stood there. He was so big, he filled the whole doorway. I saw Finley staring at him like there was something wrong with him. I followed his gaze. There were 2 things wrong with Picard. First, he didn't have Roscoe with him. Second, he was holding a government issue 38 in his giant hand. He was holding it rock steady, and he was pointing it straight at Finley.
Chapter 29.
"You?" Finley gasped.
Picard smiled a cold smile at him.
"None other," he said. "The pleasure's all mine, believe me. You've been very helpful, both of you. Very considerate. You kept me in touch every step of the way. You given me the Hubbles, and you given me Officer Roscoe. I really couldn't have asked for anything more."
Finley was rooted to the spot, shaking.
"You,"
he said again.
"Should have spotted it Wednesday, asshole," Picard said. "I sent the little guy to Joe's hotel 2 hours before I told you about it. You disappointed me. I expected to be doing this scene way before now."
He looked at us and smiled. Finley turned away, looked at me. I couldn't think of anything to say to him. I couldn't think about anything at all. I just looked at Picard's huge bulk in the doorway and had a strong feeling that this was going to be the last day of my life. Today, it would end.
"Get over there," Picard said to me, "next to Finley."
He had taken 2 giant strides into the room, and he was pointing the gun straight at me. I noticed mechanically that it was a new 38 with a short barrel. I calculated automatically that it would be accurate over such a short distance, but that a 38 couldn't be relied on to put a target down, and there were 2 of us and 1 of him, and that Finley had a weapon in a shoulder holster under the tweed jacket.
I spent a fraction of a second weighing up the odds. Then I abandoned the calculation because Mayor Teal stepped through the open door behind Picard. He had his heavy cane in his left hand, but in his right hand he was carrying a police-issue shotgun. It was an Ithaca Mag-10. Didn't really matter where he was pointing it.
"Get over there," Picard said to me again.
"Where's Roscoe?" I said to him. He laughed at me, just laughed, and gestured with the gun barrel that I should stand up and move over next to Finley. I heaved myself off the desk and stepped over. I felt like I was weighted down with lead. I clamped my lips and moved with the grim determination of a cripple trying to walk. I stood next to Finley. Teal covered us with the giant scatter gun. Picard darted his hand up under Finley's jacket, took the revolver out of his holster, slipped it into the pocket of his own enormous jacket. The jacket flapped open under the weight. It was the size of a tent. He stepped sideways and patted me down. I was unarmed. My jacket was outside in the Bentley's trunk. Then he stepped back and stood side by side with Teal. Finley stared at Picard like his heart was breaking.
"What's this all about?" Finley said. "We go back a long way, right?"
Picard just shrugged at him.
"I told you to stay away," he said. "Back in March, I tried to stop you coming down here. I warned you off. That's true, right? But you wouldn't listen, would you, you stubborn asshole? So you get what you get, my friend."
I listened to Picard's growl and felt worse for Finley than I did for myself. But then Kleiner stepped in through the door. His bone-hard face was cracked into a grin. His feral teeth glittered. His eyes bored into me. He was carrying another Ithaca Mag-10 in his left hand. In his right hand, he was carrying the gun that had killed Joe. It was pointed straight at me. It was a Ruger Mark II. A sneaky little .22 caliber automatic, fitted with a fat silencer. It was a gun for a killer who enjoys getting close. I stared at it. 9 days ago, the end of that silencer had touched my brother's temple. There was no doubt about that. I could feel it. Picard and Teal moved around behind the desk. Teal sat in the chair. Picard towered over his shoulder. Kleiner was gesturing Finley and me to sit. He was using his shotgun barrel as a baton, short, jerky movements to move us around. We sat. We were side by side in front of the big rosewood desk. We stared straight at Teal. Kleiner closed the office door and leaned on it. He held the shotgun one-handed at his hip, pointed at the side of my head. The silenced .22 was pointing at the floor. I looked hard at the three of them in turn. Old Teal was staring at me with all kinds of hate showing in his leathery old face. He was shaken up. He looked like a man under terrible stress. He looked desperate, like he was near collapse. He looked 20 years older than the smooth old guy I'd met on Monday. Picard looked better. He had the calm of a great athlete, like a football star or an Olympic champion on a visit to his old high school. But there was a tightening around his eyes, and he was rattling his thumb against his thigh. There was some strain there. I stared sideways at Kleiner, looked hard at him, but there was nothing on show. He was lean and hard and dried out. He didn't move. He was absolutely still. His face and body betrayed nothing. He was like a statue hewn from teak, but his eyes burned with a kind of cruel energy. They sneered at me out of his blank, bone-hard face. Teal rattled open a drawer in the rosewood desk, pulled out the cassette recorder Finley had used on me, handed it to Picard behind him. Picard put his revolver down on the desk and fiddled with the stiff cords. He plugged in the power, didn't bother with the microphone. They weren't going to record anything, they were going to play us something. Teal leaned forward and thumbed the intercom button on the desk. In the stillness, I heard the buzzer sound faintly outside in the squad room. "Baker?" Teal said. "In here, please."
Kleiner moved off the door and Baker came in. He was in his uniform, a .38 in his holster. He looked at me, didn't grin.
He was carrying two cassettes. Teal took them from him, selected the second one.
A tape, he said. Listen up. You're going to find this interesting.
He fiddled the cassette in and clicked the little door shut, pressed play. The motor whirred and the speaker hissed. Underneath the hiss, I could hear a boomy acoustic. Then we heard Roscoe's voice. It was loud with panic. It filled the silent office.
Richard, this is a message for you, okay? The message is, you better do what they tell you, or I'm in trouble. The message is, if you're in any doubt about what kind of trouble, you should go back down to the morgue and pull Mrs. Morrison's autopsy report. That's the kind of trouble I'm going to be in. So help me out, okay? End of message, Richard.
Her voice tailed off into the boomy hiss. I heard a faint gasp of pain as if she'd been roughly dragged away from the microphone. Then Teal snapped the recorder off. I stared at him. My temperature had dropped away to nothing. I didn't feel human anymore. Picard and Baker were looking at me, beaming in satisfaction, like they were holding the winning hole card. Teal clicked the little door open and took the tape out, laid it on one side on the desk, held up the other tape for me to see, and then put it in the machine, closed the little door again, and pressed play.
Another one, he said. Listen up.
We heard the same hiss, the same boomy acoustic. Then we heard Charlie Hubble's voice. She sounded hysterical, like she had on Monday morning, standing out on her bright gravel driveway.
Hub, this is Charlie. I've got the children with me. I'm not at home. You understand what that means? I've got to give you a message. If you don't come back, something will happen to the children. They tell me, you know what that something is. It's the same thing they said would happen to you and me, but it'll be the children instead. So you have to come back straight away, okay?
The voice ended on a rising note of panic and then died away in the boomy hiss. Teal stabbed the stop button, took the tape out and placed it carefully on the edge of the desk, right in front of me. Then Kleiner walked around into my field of vision and spoke.
You're going to take that with you, he said to me. You're going to take it to wherever you've hidden Hubble, and you're going to play it to him.
Finley and I looked at each other, just stared at each other in blank astonishment. Then I snapped back and stared at Kleiner.
You killed Hubble already, I said.
Kleiner hesitated for a second.
Don't try that shit, he said. We were going to, but you got him out of the way. You're hiding him. Charlie told us.
Charlie told you? I said.
We asked her where he was, he said. She promised us you'd be able to find him.
She was most insistent about it. We had a knife between her little girl's legs at the time. She became very anxious to convince us that her husband was not beyond our reach. She said you'd given him all sorts of advice and guidance. She said you'd given him all sorts of help. She said you'd be able to find him, I hope, for everybody's sake. She wasn't lying.
You killed him, I said again. I don't know anything about it.
Kleiner nodded and sighed. His voice was low.
Let's cut the crap, he said. You're hiding him, and we need him back. We need him back right away. It's a matter of urgency to us. We've got a business to run, so we've got a number of options. We could beat it out of you. We discussed that. It's a tactical problem, right? But we figured you might send us off in the wrong direction because time is tight right now. You might figure that was your best option, right?
He waited for some kind of a comment from me. He didn't get one.
So, what we're going to do is this, he said. Picard is going to go with you to pick him up. When you get wherever he is, Picard is going to call me. On my mobile. He knows the number.
Then you all three come on back here. Okay? I didn't respond.
Where is he? Kleiner asked suddenly. I started to speak, but he held up his hand and stopped me.
Like I told you, let's cut the crap, he said. For instance, you've been sitting there thinking as hard as you can. No doubt you were trying to figure some way you might be able to take Picard out. But you won't be able to do that.
I shrugged, said nothing.
Two problems, Kleiner said. I doubt if you could take Picard out.
I doubt if anybody could. Nobody ever has.
And my mobile number isn't written down. It's in Picard's head.
I shrugged again. Kleiner was a smart guy, the worst sort.
Let me add a couple of factors, he said. We don't know exactly how far away Hubble is, and you're not going to tell us the truth about that. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give you a time limit.
He stopped talking and walked around to where Finley was sitting. He raised the .22 and put the tip of the silencer in Finley's ear, pushed it in hard until Finley was tilting over in his chair.
The detective here is going in a cell, he said. He's going to be handcuffed to the bars. If Picard hasn't called me by 1 hour before dawn tomorrow, I'm going to aim my shotgun into the detective's cell and blow him apart. Then I'm going to make the delightful Officer Roscoe clean his guts off the back wall with a sponge. Then I'm going to give you another hour. If Picard hasn't called me by the time the sun comes up, I'm going to start in on the delightful Officer Roscoe herself. She'll end up in a lot of pain, Reacher. But first, there will be a great deal of sexual interference. A great deal. You have my word on that, Reacher. It'll be very messy. Very messy indeed. Mayor Teal and I have spent a pleasant hour discussing just exactly what we're going to do to her.
This is the end of this cassette. This program is continued on side one of cassette number 11.